which is Colleen Dolak v. County of Erie. And are you both on Zoom in that case?
Yes, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, but we just went through this cautionary tale of not being able to hear very well. So I hope we can hear you better. Let's go.
Okay, great. Your Honor, may it please the court. This morning, we are here with a case involving a career corrections nurse, a lady who served her community for many years through the Erie County Sheriff's Department's Erie County Correctional Facility. She came across a very bad situation involving her husband's health. Her husband's health had deteriorated to the point where she was forced to utilize family medical leave, sick leave, vacation leave in order to care for him, to take him for medical treatments out of town, and then in the last weeks of his life
but
to care for him.
Counsel, yes. She never told her employers any of this.
Yes, she did, Your Honor.
Did she tell
this
them
that? This was all communicated.
All right, go on. You'll direct
it was
me
communicated.
The
it was communicated via family medical leave applications, Your Honor. The employer was very well aware of what was going on with her personal life at home. The record itself is complete with the appendix. Family medical leave applications are included in exhibits. We have A27, A28, A29 through A32, all involve family medical leave. We also have A37.
Counsel, after her family leave expired,
yes,
she just stopped coming to work. She missed three hearings that were scheduled, and she just didn't...
That's not...
Okay, that's not true? Tell me
that's more. Not true. If we go to... We're going to look at the notes from the Erie County Sheriff's Employee Review File, or File Review. I am going to turn to page A48 of the appendix. A48 specifically refers to, I'm going to give you the date, September 19th. Colleen Dolak called in sick. In parentheses, it says, does not have any time available, and there were no correspondence by Mrs. Dolak to reschedule the hearing. Prior to that, there was an email regarding Ms. Dolak's job abandonment, September 14th. However, we're going to go back to we have a period. I'm just going to have to look into my brief here, Your Honor.
We can save a lot of time. Can you just show me where she told her employer that she has a disability, what that disability is, and how and what accommodation she needs for it?
Well, her disability was communicated via medical notes. She was not able to see a physician, so she was seeing a nurse practitioner.
What was wrong with her? I know her physician said she can't come to work. That's not the disability.
Anxiety, depression, and then she did have a medical note later on regarding, I believe, a sinus infection that was related, I believe, to her stress and things that she was going through. But essentially, the notes involved inability to work beginning September 15th, 2016. And the notes were not specific. I admit they were not specific regarding her actual illness until later on in her illness. It was medical that was basically
What accommodation did she seek for whatever it is she eventually said was her disability?
She sought the ability to use the 5 months of paid leave that was available to her through her union contract. It was an extended sick leave provision that was at the discretion of the Erie County Sheriff.
That's an accommodation to accommodate the fact that she's not coming into work. That's not an accommodation that allows her to do the work that she would do if she came in.
Correct, Your Honor, but the court, the Second Circuit, has never ruled specifically on the issue of whether a leave of absence can be considered an accommodation, and it has been discussed in other cases, as I've cited in my brief. I believe there's a district court case out of Connecticut that specifically references that. I'll find that for you if you just give me one moment. Let's see. Connecticut.
So the accommodation she was seeking was a 5 month leave of absence?
Well, no, it was only as necessary. Her husband passed away in November, so it would have ended up being approximately 2.5 months.
But no one knew when her husband was going to die.
Well, that is correct. But at that point, as I've mentioned in my brief, if we use the analysis from the Beck decision from the Seventh Circuit, there is an interactive process that should have gone on between her and her employer.
Which she has to start. She has to start the interactive process. Did she start it?
I believe she did, yes. I believe she provided the notes that she wasn't able to work, and she did call in. She did actually make one or more telephone calls to her employer, specifically with reference to the disciplinary hearings that she wasn't able to attend because of her mental condition, that she wasn't emotionally capable of appearing for those disciplinary hearings. A disciplinary hearing is a very stressful event, and
well,
she had so much stress.
Being a nurse is very stressful work.
Carol
Buckley,
join the meeting.
That is correct. But she wasn't able to work in her nursing capacity, and that's the whole argument of her need to use this leave. This leave was available to her, and it was arbitrarily denied to her.
What are your strongest factual allegations that defendants were discriminating based on associational discrimination?
Time proximity. Her family medical leave ran out arguably in the sometime of August 10th, although my client believes it was actually the first week of September. The first disciplinary hearing was scheduled for the middle of September, so we had basically about a month's time from when her FMLA ran out, and then she had some accumulated sick and vacation time, which essentially all ran out without question by the beginning of September. So within 2 weeks of her leave running out, all her sick and vacation, all the things she was entitled to up until that point in time, outside of the special 5 month provision of the union contract, they began a disciplinary proceeding. They didn't even offer her. They didn't refer her to the employee assistance program.
Judge Gujarati asked about associational discrimination.
Yes, I'm running off the topic. Specifically, her husband was on her health insurance plan. Her husband's care was quite expensive. As you said, they didn't know when he was going to die. And in combination with the fact there was a 5 month additional paid leave available to my client, which coincidentally would have started within 2 weeks of the first disciplinary hearing.
Is the associational claim that you are making based upon her association by marriage with a person who has a cancer diagnosis?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct.
She wasn't terminated until a year and a half after the cancer diagnosis.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So I don't
but,
know what, where is this proximity that you're talking about?
Well, I think the greatest proximity is to the 5 months of additional paid leave. At that point, obviously, they couldn't have terminated her during her FMLA period. They knew they would have run into federal legal consequences of that. And she did have sick and vacation time that she was using, which she had accrued. So the proximity is to her loss, exhaustion. The best term is her exhaustion of her standard employee accrued benefits, her exhaustion of FMLA, and her entitled, her beginning of her the potential use of the extended 5 month sick leave period.
All right, counsel, your time has long expired, but you have 3 minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from the county.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Honor Joshua Feinstein for the county. I'm going to be brief. There's not, you know, the issue here is whether she's sufficiently alleged disability discrimination and denial of a reasonable accommodation. Her first problem is I don't believe that she's alleged disability. Obviously, she's claiming now that she was depressed, but there's nothing in the record until you actually get to the complaint in this matter when they file in federal court that she indicating depression.
But the people who her employers knew that her husband was in very serious condition and, in fact, had a diagnosis that was terminal. Didn't they know that?
They certainly knew that he was suffering from cancer, but that's different as to whether they knew that she herself was suffering a disability of any sort. And there's absolutely no indication that they knew or they were notified in any way that she would have been suffering a disability within the meaning of the ADA. They're relying on these very bare-bone notes, which are at A61-63, which just say DBL. That's all they say. Disability, you know, that can mean various things in various contexts. That certainly did not give them notice that she was disabled within the meaning of the ADA.
But didn't that raise the issue when she said, I'm disabled?
I think these are no more than sick notes. That's all they are. You know, out 2 weeks, DBL. I don't know how that can be reasonably construed as...
She told them she was disabled.
I do not believe... You know, if you look at the case law, you have to put the employer on notice that you're... And I'm actually... There's this recent Second Circuit case which was cited by Magistrate Judge Schroeder below Costable that says the employee on notice that the employee has a disability within the meaning of the act as opposed to a mere impairment. And further, you know, there's other authority that the employee's request for an accommodation must be sufficiently direct and specific. All you have here are a series of three notes where she keeps on pushing out the hearing by 2 weeks based on a nurse's note indicating DBL. And that is simply not sufficient to trigger the interactive process. Additionally, again, you know, she's claiming that she was disabled because her impairment was depression. The medical record doesn't support that she ever complained of depression at the time. If you go to the nurse's notes, it's in the record. I'm sorry, it's at, at A251. If you go to Nurse Oswald's note of September 16, if you go to, there's a treatment note, not what was given to the county. The county was just given this little prescription pad saying DBL. But there's a treatment note from Nurse Oswald. Migraines occurring daily from all her stress, feeling weak with productive cough and fatigue. There's nothing indicating that she presented with symptoms or complained of depression or any other mental impairment. Similarly, also same date, there's a note from a second doctor, a Dr. Bhagavra. Apparently, she was doing a little form shopping with these physicians. She went to two of them. Dr. Bhagavra apparently was only willing to write her a note for a week. And he diagnosed a sore throat. So it's somewhat convenient that at the complaint stage that they're saying that she's depressed. And in fact, if you look at the allegations of the complaint, this woman deserves our sympathy. Her husband was dying. She has five children. She was struggling with a lot. But the complaint's own allegations was that she was a very capable person. She was organizing her husband's care. She was traveling with him to Atlanta. She was, as a nurse, she was basically a private duty nurse for him. She was helping him with IVs, with medications, with personal hygiene. I mean, this is not a person suffering from a disability. They simply haven't alleged that. The fact that she was overwhelmed taking care of her husband does not mean that she was disabled within the meaning of the act, as unfortunate as her situation may have been. Okay. I've already referenced notice. There wasn't anything here that allowed the county, gave the county any idea that she was alleging a disability within the meaning of the act that may have triggered the interactive process. Let's see.
Is she presently reemployed at the hospital?
My understanding is that she is. That she was certainly offered reinstatement as part of the union grievance process by the arbitrator. Okay.
Thank you.
My understanding, though, she's employed elsewhere presently. Okay. Unless the court has further questions, then I will rest.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cott, you have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes. On behalf of my client, I take offense with the statement that my client was doctor shopping, seeing two separate healthcare providers for an illness that was going on for a significant period of time is not doctor shopping. The nurse note on A251, the nurse practitioner note, refers to migraines, refers to stress, refers to weakness, dizziness. I'm not a doctor. I'm not medically trained, but I can only assume that as part of a complex situation involving anxiety and depression, that migraines certainly could become a part of that situation. And unfortunately, the employer never requested any further clarification regarding this at the time this was submitted. So we don't have anything to present to the court regarding this, but the employer certainly had the opportunity to reach out to my client, which they did not do.
Are they required to? Are you arguing that they're required to?
Yes, obviously it's not in the Second Circuit, but out of the Seventh Circuit, the Beck decision specifically has employers and employees both required to, in good faith, continue the dialogue, if you will. The interactive process is not a one-sided process. It's not totally the employee who is required to continue to provide information. When there is a lack of information, when the employer is uncertain, it's pretty clear in the law that it's just common sense based upon the federal regulations regarding the disability determination process that the employer should have reached out when the employee is essentially in a situation where maybe she's weak, maybe she's essentially having a hard time communicating as she appears to have had migraine headaches, weakness, dizziness, are not conditions normally a person is in the best frame of mind to think of all the possible facts that should be presented to her employer. She probably thought that this was enough unless she heard more from the employer that this was enough, that this was sufficient. I mean, the case from Wisconsin, the Beck case, it clearly says a party that fails to communicate by way of initiation or response may also be acting in bad faith. In essence, the court should attempt to isolate the cause of the breakdown and then assign responsibility. Here we know the client was sick. My client was ill. She was having great difficulty. So I think the burden should be placed upon the employer to justify why they didn't reach out, why they didn't further the process. It's a large police department. They have over 500 employees. They have deputies that routinely go out and make welfare checks on people. It's a known...
Counsel, your time has expired. In conclusion, you want to tell us?
Yeah, in conclusion, the employer had the resources to reach out to my client. It would not have been a great burden on them to have sent a deputy over to inquire or even just to have picked up the phone and called her and contacted her.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll reserve decision.